Good morning. It's Saturday, November 8th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with author and essayist Tim Brooks, director of Champlain College's professional writing program. Tim's work has been published in Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Outside, The Boston Globe, American History, and some 50 other publications. A contributing essayist for National Public Radio, he holds an MA from Pembroke College, Oxford. He has written 7 books, all of them with 2-part titles: A Hell of a Place to Lose a Cow, An American Hitchhiking Odyssey; Guitar, An American Life; The Driveway Diaries, A Dirt Road Almanac; Catching My Breath, An Asthmatic Explores His Illness; A Warning Shot, Influenza and the 2004 Flu Vaccine Shortage; and Behind the Mask, How the World Survived SARS, the First Epidemic of the 21st Century. As we were mainly discussing Guitar and American Life, when Tim and I spoke in October, we chose to do so in the semi-soundproof teaching booth at Burlington Guitar and Amp, in hopes that guitars might be audible in the background. They weren't, but we tried. In Guitar and American Life, you weave together 3 threads, really. Your own story of the loss of your guitar and the pursuit of its replacement, the history of the guitar in America, and the more technical aspects of how guitars are played and built and how they sound. I was curious if this structure evolved as you worked, or did you know from the start how you wanted to fit the book together?
Huh, that's funny. You found 3 threads where I found only 2.5. When my previous guitar, which had been sort of this very close friend of mine for many years, got broken, and I started thinking about what to do next, the first thing I had in mind actually was a road trip. I had this notion of doing this kind of wild road trip, driving all around the U.S., visiting guitar makers and interviewing them sort of on site. That didn't work out because I felt there would be quite a lot of repetition involved. There's only so many times you can say, you know, and in the workshop there's this and this, you know, it's the same stuff. Plus the fact that it would take a lot of time and money to go on a road trip. So when I discovered that Rick Davis lived about a 15-minute drive away and, you know, was really a master guitar maker, that really seemed like a much better alternative just from a very practical point of view. Plus, he turned out to be a very interesting guy, very funny, nice kind of curmudgeonly streak about him. So that was the one thread, which is the making of the guitar. I think it was when I first went to his workshop, I saw that he had on the wall a really very, very strange guitar, very unusual one, and it's a plastic guitar made by Mario McAferry. Mario McAferry, remarkable guy, was actually a concert guitarist, a classical guitarist, mm-hmm. early in the 20th century, but was also sort of a dabbler and an inventor and all this kind of stuff, and he actually went to the Selma Guitar Company in Paris and proposed a revolutionary design which had sort of a guitar within a guitar. And they made a few of those, and it became famous because Django Reinhardt played one of them for a while. And then McAferry and Selma sort of drifted apart and had disagreements, and in fact Django stopped playing a McAferry and carried on playing a standard Selma. McAferry winds up coming to the United States and, always kind of thinking creatively, winds up making plastic ukuleles and plastic guitars, and apparently he sold something like 900,000 plastic ukuleles, not because he was trying to make junk, but because he was trying to make a cutting-edge instrument using these new materials that were just becoming available. And, of course, now we look back on it and think of it as being junk. And certainly this plastic guitar was sort of hideous. It had all these ridiculous sort of rococo flourishes around the headstock and everything.
Plastic?
Yeah.
All plastic.
All plastic. But the thing that fascinated me about it was I realized that that guitar could only have been made at a very specific place and time in history. Any earlier, the materials wouldn't have been available, or they wouldn't have been strong enough to hold up. Any later, and the novelty of plastic will have worn off, and people would have said, you know what, it really sounds like crap, we're going to go back to making them with wood, all this kind of thing. I had this notion in my mind that because the guitar is more malleable, in other words, more subject to change and invention and tinkering than any other instrument, that every guitar made bears the thumbprint of the person who made it and the time and place where it was made.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, boy, you know, this is also a history of America. And I started doing some research. I tracked down every reference to the word guitar in the New York Times starting in 1851 and moving forward, because, you could now search it. It was fascinating because as the guitar was not especially popular then, and it wasn't sort of like rock star sexy, when a guitar does turn up in an article, it's not the point of the article. It's sort of in the corner. It's like going into a room and looking around and barely even noticing that there's a guitar in the corner propped up against the piano or whatever. And so all of these stories I was reading were just extraordinary stories, and the guitar was there almost as a bystander. And I started having this notion of the guitar as a keyhole through which you actually saw American history.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, it was the history of the guitar, but in a way, it was really a social history of America seen through the eyes of the guitar, so to speak. Once I got those two ideas in mind, I thought, right, I'm going to try braiding them. I'm just going to go sort of back and forth, and both of them are going to lead up to the present moment. So by the end of the book, the guitar that's being made for me by Rick Davis is finished, and the history of the guitar in America has reached the present day. The other half thread that I had is that I kept on coming across thoughts and observations and things that didn't really fit very easily into either of those, and so I kept on writing them down in a journal fashion as interludes, and I really loved some of those interludes. They were really about a variety of things, but they're about the meaning of the guitar in the most subjective manner possible.
Mm-hmm.
What does the guitar mean to the guitarist? What does the guitar mean to the listener? A number of those interludes cropped up as well. And
okay.
We actually gave them a different font so that it looked deliberate as opposed to accidental.
Right. And actually, I suppose my third braid that I was talking about is really Rick building the guitar.
Right.
And you're talking about the technical aspects as an offshoot of watching your guitar be made, which was great. It was really fun to read because you never go on for very, very long before you're back into this other part, you know, and it all comes together so nicely.
I'm a great fan of short chapters, partly because I don't want to bore people, but also partly because if you write something that's very, very short, ironically, people may actually think about it for a whole lot longer. After all, this is the basis on which poetry has been surviving, you know, for a few thousand years.
I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read.
Sure. I thought I'd pick a piece that, nothing is really representative of the book as a whole, but I thought I'd pick a piece which is suitable for the circumstances of our recording, because here we are in Burlington Guitar and Amp in the teaching booth. And one of the first things that happened really at the beginning of this whole process was, even before I had thought of having a guitar made for me, because at some point in here I say, you know, I've never had anything more complicated or expensive made for me in my life than a chicken sandwich. I thought, okay, well, I'll buy a guitar. And I spent quite some time in guitar shops, sort of hanging out and talking to people and playing guitars and things. And that was really, first of all, when I made a sort of a realization about guitars, which is that I didn't want a new guitar. You know, as a guitarist, there is a certain appeal to having a new guitar, but in many ways, there's more appeal to having a guitar that is so familiar that, you know, it curls up on your lap like a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And all these new guitars, they all seem to kind of brittle and dry. But on the other hand, I had a great time hanging out in guitar shops. So I'm just going to read this one paragraph, which really came about from hanging out in Burlington Guitar and Amp, amongst other places. So
So this is Tim Brooks reading an excerpt from his book, Guitar and American Life, published by...
Grove Atlantic.
Grove Atlantic.
I spent hours hanging out, fooling around with this guitar or that, and decided in passing someone should write a sociology of the guitar store. Even when guitars were sold at more general music stores, or even at furniture stores or small-town general stores, the store offered more to the guitarist than just a new guitar. Guitar stores have functioned as message centers for local musicians, as teaching studios. Field recordings often took place in music stores, and music store owners often acted as official or unofficial talent scouts for record companies. Many guitar makers learned their trade by doing repairs in a store's back room or basement. And the first consistent sets of electric guitar strings were put together and sold by a music store owner. Because guitar stores are often owned by guitarists, they've also become places where their mates can come and hang out, thus serving as social centers and even old guitarists' homes. Most interesting of all, a guitar store is the only place in the known universe where a guy will allow himself to shop like a woman. Spending half an hour, 2 hours, trying a dozen guitars with only the faintest possibility of actually buying something, playing a few licks, swapping a few lies, while in the background someone plays the opening bars of Stairway to Heaven.
That was actually really fun to read because my son plays the guitar, and he'll have me drop him off at a guitar store and say, come back in an hour. And at first I was like, I'm not sure that's okay, but it really is. That happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, hearing you read that reminds me that I know that you did a book on tape version of guitar in American history, and you read it yourself. So I have two questions about that. First of all, how does it come about that you get offered the opportunity to have a book on tape come out from your book? And secondly, how was the experience of reading it yourself?
Well, there's actually a third piece in there, which is that several of my books are actually available in audio version. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, I think in pretty much all cases, I only found out about this after that had already been assigned. I got a phone call from some guy with an English accent saying that the Library of Congress had hired him to read my book, A Hell of a Place to Lose a Cow.
Okay.
And I thought, what about me? You know, I would have been very happy to read that book. And, you know, they might have paid me some money or maybe they wouldn't. But I would have loved to read that. And instead, the publisher had sold the rights to the Library of Congress at some special low rate because they have a grant for making books available for the visually impaired, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. It's just that I wanted to read it. And then I discovered that this guy who was reading it, he wasn't an actor. He didn't need the money, which, of course, I did. He was actually a retired CIA agent or something along those lines. I thought, this is ridiculous. You know, why are we supporting retired CIA agents? I really wanted to read it. I actually suggested to the publisher, the book publisher, you know, I really think this would work as a book on tape, and I'd like to do it, and I'd like to push this, etc. So they have a rights and permissions department, and the rights and permissions people try and sell any rights they can possibly make money for. They try and sell. One of the rights that they sell is, if they can, is this audio right. So they did that, and they sold it to a company called Blackstone Audio out in Oregon, who said, well, as a matter of course, we don't have the author read the book. You know, we have an actor because most authors are terrible readers. And again, it was within, you know, half an inch of being completely out of my hand and the whole thing being a done deal.
Did you say, can I audition?
Well, actually, what I said was, you know, I do stuff NPR all the time. Go to the NPR site and listen to some of my archived stuff there. And so with a certain amount of unwillingness, they did so. And they said, oh, you know, well, you know, maybe we will give you a shot. I love the performance aspect of reading out loud. I love the sense that I'm reading to someone. You have to be careful when you're reading something as long as a book that it doesn't become routine. The stuff I do for NPR, you know, it's like 2 minutes, 15 seconds. It's a short blast, you know. But reading a book, it was actually sort of important to take breaks regularly so that, you know, I didn't start sounding as if I was just kind of going, you know, da-dum, 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 that kind of thing.
Early in the book, when you're meeting with Rick Davis, the guitar maker, you write the following. We discussed the arcane specs I've started to hear about, scale length, nut width. These technicalities start making me uncomfortable. How can you call yourself a guitarist and not even know something as basic as the right nut width? I was happier 20 years ago being ignorant, picking out a guitar because I was besotted with the name, buying the only model I could afford. I loved this quote, and part of why I loved it is that it applies to so many disciplines, including writing. This must have been a constant theme for you as you were writing the book, because you're learning all this stuff about the guitar, and it's constantly more and more information and detail. Is that true? Or?
Well, it actually touches on a broader subject, I think, that was really the something that the, one of the best editors I ever had understood very well. This was a woman called Judith Moore, who lived in Berkeley, but actually edited the San Diego Reader, which is this phenomenal weekly newspaper that's like 196 pages every week. And for a while I was doing, they would fly me over there every 6 months and I would do a cover story for them, which was just a great gig. And her way of assigning stories was not to say, you know, so what have you got? What do you know that's interesting? You know, the typical stuff. She would say, what do you want to spend 3 months learning about? And I talk about this to my students all the time, that if you write from a sense of curiosity and you write, and the process of writing is a process of discovery, then that, first of all, means that everything you do is interesting to you. Secondly, it means that that sense of and that delight of discovery really comes across in your prose as you're writing it. It also means that you don't artificially limit the range of things that you write about. If you start out thinking, I'm going to write about this, and then you stick to it, then all of the really interesting stuff where you're starting to make connections, you know, that really span almost infinite distances between one subject and another, between one theme and another, between one country and another, you know, that isn't there. You've sort of mentally forbidden yourself to do that. Mm-hmm. I tell my writing students, no, your only obligation is to be interesting. Mm-hmm. And if you start out by saying, okay, I have to get this in here and I have to put that in there and I must know about that. And that did happen when I was working on the guitar book. I was thinking, oh, you know, I really don't like guitar jazz from 1945 to 1955. And I put off having anything to do with that. And I thought, I really don't like country guitar. And I put off having, and I thought, oh, I've got to learn that stuff, etc., etc. And eventually, what I realized was that I didn't have to put everything in there. And secondly, you can actually change that question around and you can say, why is it that in that 1945 to 55 period, jazz guitar sounds like this, and why is it that, given that you like guitar so much, why is that something you don't like? And that turns out to be a very, very interesting question, and it touches on a whole bunch of other things. So it all comes down to slavery. You know, if you turn yourself into a slave, if you become a slave to your material or to your subject, anything you write about can be drudgery. And certainly rewriting and re-rewriting will definitely be drudgery. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, what you do is you say, my only obligation is to be interesting. I'm and coherent, probably. And I'm going to bring stuff into this that nobody else would even think of bringing into this. Right. Then there's a challenge, there's this sense of discovery, and it just never gets dull.
Yeah. This book cover so much. I'm curious, how did you approach the research?
When I was younger, I was absolutely not a researcher and no fan of libraries at all. In fact, I went to school at Oxford, which has one of the best libraries in the world, and I only ever went in there twice. Once to sign up, and once because there was this girl I fancied who I'd seen got in there, and I thought, oh, I'll go and see if I can find her. And of course, you know, the place is a labyrinth. You can't find anybody. And it wasn't until I started working on my first book, which was Catching My Breath, which is about asthma, that all that changed. And I discovered a database called Medline. And I would type in things like asthma and vitamins, asthma and migraine, you know, that kind of thing. All of these articles would come up, and some of them were just so technical I couldn't understand them. But some of them were just fascinating and that was when I really discovered serendipity, and the fact that, you know, online databases, searchable databases, the internet in general is really a vast serendipity machine. And this was so life-changing an activity, and all of a sudden, you know, the horizons just sort of rushed back.
Now that must have been fairly early on in the internet's.
Yeah, exactly. That
reach.
That was in the days when at the time I was teaching at UVM, you could only access it through the UVM library's computers. They didn't have internet as we understand it right now. They had LexisNexis, mm-hmm. but you had to sign up for that. They had Medline, which has been going since the early 80s. LexisNexis has been going since the early 80s. I don't know how long Medline's been going. I think maybe 84. But, yeah, it was really early. And as soon as I started doing this, I realized that at no point in human history would I have been able to do this until now.
Yeah.
And so for this book, first of all, the New York Times stuff was just wonderful because, I mean, who wouldn't want to come across the story of Strenuous Lifer, the pig at the Bronx Zoo who'd been killed by Burry the Lion because he was too slow getting off stage, and that one of the things that made Strenuous Lifer such an accomplished and notable pig was that he played the guitar. Apart from, I mean, obviously that's very, very funny, but it also occurs to me that why did they mention the fact that he played the guitar? Because it's an image of absurdity, and it means he slept under a coverlet, he ate sitting at a table, and he played the guitar. And that in itself says something about the way in which the guitar was seen at the time. There was another story I came across of some college students who basically were acting like college students nowadays. They were being employed at a hotel on Long Island, and they basically were just kind of like not turning up for work and getting drunk and trashing the place and whatnot. And eventually the owner can stand it no longer, and he calls the local constable over to throw him out because he tries to fire them and they say, "We won't go." And they're just hanging out on the lawn or something. And the constable has an Irish name, and he says to these kids, "Get out of here and take your guitars and your fancy socks with you." And straight away you can see, you know, that to this Irish cop, these kids are the idle rich.
Yeah.
You know, they can afford to just sit around doing nothing and play guitars.
Which is so funny because one thing you do point out in the book is that the guitar is the instrument of the disenfranchised and the poor. I mean, the stories about Jimi Hendrix were really heartbreaking, but inspiring, you know, that this was the one thing that he wanted to do,
yeah.
and he did it.
The guitar has survived because it is or can be the instrument of the disenfranchised or poor. Periodically, it's also become popular among the middle class and the upper middle class, mm-hmm. like in the 1640s, for example, in England. That doesn't mean that, the middle classes are notoriously fickle. You know, next week it's Casio's, no one wants a guitar kind of thing. But because it's, you know, it's portable and it's cheap and it's easy to play on a basic level, et cetera, et cetera, it means that it's always got a refuge there.
Right.
And in a way that the piano, for example, which is the guitar's big rival in American history, really doesn't, because even though there have been poor families with pianos, it's not exactly cheap, it's not exactly portable, and so you're much more likely to be able to survive, you know, with a guitar or a piece of tissue paper and a comb or something like that.
I'm curious what your evolution as a writer has been. When did you begin to write, and in what genres have you worked?
To me, the most interesting thing about my evolution as a writer is that it took me a long time, and I think this is probably quite common, to realize that everything I was writing was pretentious, derivative crap. because I had sort of come up through the studying literature route. And if you are an English major and you do the studying literature stuff, then essentially what you're told implicitly all the time is, this is what it's supposed to look like. Chances are you will never be able to match up to this, but if you want to be a writer, this is the kind of thing you have to do. So essentially you imitate, and you imitate style, you imitate voice, you imitate content, and all that kind of stuff. So I started out writing poetry and then short stories, and really, I didn't really have a very clear sense at all of what I actually wanted them to do. I sort of wanted someone to come over and pat me on the head and say, yes, you know, you are now a writer, or yes, this is very good, or whatever. Which is such a bogus ambition, and it's so passive. You know, it means that you're always looking to somebody else for where you should go or what you should do. The good fortune in my life was that in around 1982, I was teaching at UVM and writing in my spare time and et cetera, et cetera. And I lost my job. They literally fired all of the part-timers. And so I started working for the local weekly, which in those days was the Vanguard. Mm-hmm. I found journalism in general really easy because in England, essay-based education or essay-based testing was what I grew up on. And what that really meant was take everything you know, put it in together into a piece of coherent writing in 45 minutes, and then go on to the next subject, which is a great training for journalism. So I started out doing sort of arts-type reviews, which was easy enough because, you know, I had done the whole English major literary criticism thing and some journalism. And within a few weeks, I was doing probably 4 or 5 articles every week and being paid maybe 20 or 25 bucks an article. But I loved it because for the first time with the journalism stuff, I was writing stuff that was actually useful to people, you know, that they might need. Whereas the poetry I had been writing, all of it could have been burned without any loss to the human race whatsoever. And here, first of all, there was a sense that people that I knew were actually reading it, and some people would come and say, that was pretty funny, or wow, or whatever. And secondly, there was income attached to it as opposed to, you know, this is a hobby you do in your spare time, so you never really know if you're doing it right or if you're doing it well. Whereas if you're working for an editor, the editor says, you know, too long, too short, too dull, and when you get it right, they give you a check, you know. So the challenge then was to go beyond what was immediately possible. And I've always been a very ambitious writer, not in the sense of wanting to be famous or to be rich, but in the sense of wanting a piece of writing to be the very best thing it could possibly be, to mm-hmm. do things that no one has ever done with a piece of writing. It's really sad to look back on some of the things that I wrote in those very early days where I was doing something which involved pretty much just like rewriting a press release, as you tend to do when you start out. And I would put so much effort and creativity into that just to try and make it something interesting and special because I couldn't abide the idea of doing something that was just dull, you know. And so really, that's when I discovered nonfiction, or what is now called creative nonfiction. And so I was doing humor, I was doing reviews, I was doing straight journalism, I was doing feature journalism. I was doing some very kind of creative meta-journalism type of stuff. And the fact that I was being paid so little was actually a good thing because it meant that I could afford to take a whole bunch of risks. The papers that I was working for, you know, didn't have a whole queue of Nobel Prize winning writers waiting to write for them, so they weren't actually going to say never darken our doors again if I did something that was sort of strange. And so that period of 83, 84, 85 was very, very creative. It was full of all kinds of exploration and sort of risk-taking. I sort of regard that as the period that really got me up and rolling. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that I wrote then that I went back to 5, 10, 15 years later and rewrote maybe just a little and then sold again. So there was a piece that I did for the Vanguard that made me maybe 20 bucks that probably in the late 90s I sold to an airline magazine and made 1500 bucks. And it was pretty much the same piece. And it was sort of like, huh, because that really teaches you something about the whole issue of writing as a career, yeah. Which it has nothing to do with the quality of what you're writing or who you're writing for. So much of it has to do with understanding the market, getting to know who is actually interested in your writing. And once you find editors are on the same wavelength as you are, then you are much more likely to be able to make a living doing what you've been doing all along than you ever thought would be possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you structure your time when you're working on a book of this nature, like guitar? Do you research it while you're writing something else, or are you doing all the research and writing at sort of at the same general period of time?
My life has changed a lot in the last 2 years since I took over the 3 years since I took over the writing program at Champlain, because that now takes up so much of my time. But really, at any point up until then, I've always been working on multiple things at the same time. Mm-hmm. And part of that is out of necessity, because, you know, if you're a freelance writer and you only work on one thing, you know, then very soon you're living off rice-a-roni for the rest of your life. You know? Part of it is because it's really important to be aware of where your energy and your interests are. A lot of people, when they write, they get to a point where they don't want, or it becomes an effort to work on that particular thing, and they think that that's something wrong with them, or they have writer's block, or whatever. And really all it means is you should stop writing that right now, and you should do something else, and have faith that the interest will come back. And so when I was writing Hell of a Place to Lose a Cow, I got into this fantastic rhythm where I was living out in Essex in the countryside. I would write for about half an hour, and then I would go and mow the lawn or work in the garden. And I would get all hot and sweaty. And because, you know, mowing the lawn, especially our lawn, is such hard work and so tedious, that my mind would be working while I was kind of going up and down and struggling with the lawn, and I would have more thoughts. So then I would come inside and I would write them up, and then I would go and do the dishes or something, and then I would go back out in the garden again. And that worked extremely well. At that point, I was probably also stopping to do a newspaper column I was doing every couple of weeks. I was probably doing an NPR piece. I think I was still doing film reviews at the time. So there would have been time, you know, where I said, you know, it's Wednesday, I've got to do my film review or whatever. But there was enough. It's sort of like crop rotation. You know, you have to rotate the crops in a given field, because otherwise you just, you know, take all the nutrients out of the soil. So that really worked out very well. And with the guitar book, I actually stopped in the middle of the guitar book to write the Sars book. Mm-hmm. Because my friend Omar Khan came to me and suggested that in mid-November. And he said, we need it written by the beginning of March. Mm-hmm. And because it was the first book that I had a chance to do that really had a kind of a global vision, and because I said, well, you know, you'll have to send me to Hong Kong then, he said, okay.
Wow. What's the name of that book?
That's called Behind the Mask.
Okay.
That one was very, I had to be very disciplined. I spent a month just doing research ahead of time, or most of it online, reading newspapers from all over the world in the library, because I knew nothing about SARS when I started. Mm-hmm. Learning the whole background, reading the Hong Kong newspapers, reading the Straits Times from Singapore, reading the Canadian newspapers, just doing a tremendous amount of that stuff and just trying to get my head around what had happened, because I hadn't really been paying attention while it was happening. And then there was essentially a month actually going out on the road, and I went to Geneva to interview the people at the WHO, and to Hong Kong and China, and to Toronto, where they'd had, you know, a big outbreak. And then I had about 3 weeks to write it.
Oh my gosh.
And it actually was immensely good. It was a great experience, because I had to write a chapter a day. And if you have to write a chapter a day, but you've done your research, then it simply becomes a question of sitting down and saying, okay, this chapter is going to be on Taiwan. What happened in Taiwan? So tell the story of Taiwan. Right? And so you sit down and you write it, and every so often you know that there's this quote from this one doctor you want to put in there, and so you look it up and you bung it in there. And it means that it gets written in a very conversational, very direct, very clean sort of fashion. Mm-hmm. It can't get bogged down by too much detail or too much theory or too many different points of view coming in. And so I did it. I wrote the whole thing in about 3 weeks, and then rewrote it a couple of times, and then sent it off, you know, to my editor. And then when I went back to the guitar book, it was actually very helpful, because I had been doing enough research, and especially enough academic research, that part of me was still thinking, you have to include everything you know, which of course is deadly. And I wrote the first 4 or 5 chapters, and I realized that if I kept on like that, the book would be 900 pages long. So I threw all of that out, and I said, okay, imagine you're writing the SARS book again. Chapter 1, Spanish colonial history. What do you got to say about that? And I told myself 2 things. One, I'm only going to include the stuff that is interesting and well-written. Because, you know, I'd written chunks and pieces as I was researching it, and it was only the stuff that I really liked the writing that I put in at first. And then I said, okay, what else do I absolutely have to put in that chapter?
What's missing.
Yeah, exactly. And so consequently, that made the book much easier to write. It gave it a completely different flavor. And then afterwards, when I went back over it and I looked at my notes and said, you know, I was thinking of including this and this and this and this, I kept on saying, you know what? It doesn't really need that. It doesn't really need that. It cannot be encyclopedic, mm-hmm. you know. And I wouldn't want to write an encyclopedia because encyclopedias tend to be kind of dull, frankly.
Right, and who would your reader be for an encyclopedia?
Exactly. So that's the way it happened.
Mm-hmm. I want to know what you're working on now. What your writing has been like recently?
Well, I've sort of undergone a series of professional disasters from all kinds of strange directions. All of these are, I won't go through all of them, but all of them are worth knowing about for your listeners. Anybody who's a writer can benefit from knowing that these things just happen. And some of them I may have caused, some of them I may have partly caused, some of them are completely beyond my control. The first one that happened was that the editor who had worked with me on the guitar book, whom I got on with absolutely fantastically, I sort of assumed that Grove Atlantic would sort of say, okay, this book has gone really well, what are you going to do for us next? In fact, that didn't happen. That editor wound up having a falling out with her boss. She went to a different publishing house. And the net result of that was that neither of them wanted to have anything to do with me, not because of my book, but because of the turf war that was going on. And without realizing it, and I didn't know anything about this, for 18 months, I had become toxic property, but only to those 2 editors. But those are the 2 editors who had a claim on me, because when you sign a contract, you know, there's this question of they also get you to sign the right of refusal of the first refusal of the next book. And so whatever my next book was, suddenly it was mined. You know, it couldn't possibly work. And it actually took 18 months to figure out what was going on and to propose a next book that they then turned down, which meant that I was no longer under that obligation. So that was a very bizarre situation. And it had nothing to do with me as a person or as a writer. But because I had fired my agent, I didn't have anybody on the inside who could find out what the heck was going on and let me know about all of this stuff. My agent hadn't done anything for me for years, but I hadn't realized that not having an agent would make me vulnerable in this peculiar respect, in this very specific circumstance.
Because it left you out of the loop.
Absolutely. Mm. Then some other things happened. More recently, I started working with a new agent, actually a pair of agents, and they said, we really love your writing, we'd love to represent you. And they said, we have a book idea that we think you would be perfect for, and we know we can sell this book. We know it will sell. And as the ideas I had, they were kind of lukewarm about, and I like a challenge. I said, sure. So I spent 6 months working up a proposal for this book idea of theirs, which I won't go into. It's a very long explanation. And it didn't sell. They had been wrong about the market. And the editors who saw it said, yes, we like his writing. You know, we loved his other book, this or his other book, that. But this particular subject, you know, we think the market isn't ready for it, or we think the market has too many of these books already, blah, blah, blah. Then I was contacted by a producer and a cinematographer who wanted to do a documentary series for PBS based on my guitar book. And this sounded very exciting, and they even wrote me a little check ahead of time saying, you know, this is part payment for you to help us write the teaser for this, which we're going to pitch to PBS. And then I remembered that 2 years ago I was interviewed by the BBC for a series they were doing about the guitar, and they wanted to use my book as the basis for that. But the series had run into all kinds of trouble, and I had been emailing periodically with the producer, and he'd been telling me all kinds of tales of disaster, and it sounds as if it wasn't going to happen. So I thought, oh, I'd better check. So I emailed him, and I said, did anything ever come of that? He said, oh, it's been a disaster, blah, 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 but the first episode is airing on Saturday. And from my point of view, it was the worst of all possible worlds, because I had been at the heart of this BBC project, but over the course of time, so many other people had got involved in it that I had been shunted aside. And so I now appear on screen briefly, and I get acknowledged in the credits, but it's not selling thousands of copies of my book the way that we'd originally hoped it might, and I'm sort of a minuscule feature of this. But I'm sufficiently at the heart of the ideas in the series still that the series replicated so perfectly what these two guys in this country wanted to pitch to PBS that as soon as they heard about it, they both fled for the hills saying, we can't compete with the BBC, forget it.
Right.
So all of a sudden, my dream of writing this six-part series for PBS also disappeared. So that collapsed. So all of these things have combined with the fact that now so much of my time is taken up with working at Champlain, that all of a sudden I've become a different person. Instead of being a freelance writer who also did some teaching, I'm now the director of a writing program, and the writing that I do for myself has now, I won't say it's dried up, I'm working on a project about anticipation. I've become very interested in the notion of anticipation because it's not something that I typically do. But I've discovered that simply by having something to look forward to, it changes your whole perspective on everything you do. And so there's a kind of a meta quality here whereby in writing a book about looking forward to things, I've given myself something to look forward to. And I'm writing it in a way that I haven't written anything ever before. It's sort of like, it's almost like Tristram Shandy in that it just goes everywhere. So there's a chapter called A Tribute to Carly Simon, you know, because of her song Anticipation. There's a chapter called Do Dogs Dream of Dinner? At the moment, I'm just saying to myself, you know what? You've got to have a good time writing something. What happens to that is something that you can look forward to if you like, but at the moment, you just need to look forward to having something to write.
Right.
And so the next thing that I'm going to do is I've just been reading a series of articles from psychological and brain research journals. I'm going to be emailing a bunch of these researchers and throwing questions at them. And there's something wonderfully impish about that I like, because I'm not an expert and they are, but I have questions that I think they haven't considered, and so I'm curious to see what they have to say. And that's really been one of the recurrent themes in all my science writing and my health writing, is that I've been asking questions that I thought were like dumb questions or outsiders questions, and often they've been the question that the researcher hasn't addressed because they haven't known how to address it or because they've never thought of it. And that becomes fun.
Yeah, it sounds almost like you're stepping back to that point in your writing where it was just all about the fun of writing and the passion of pursuing it for your own interest.
I hope so. Oh, and two other things have happened. My producer at NPR, whom I was working with for 15 years or something, who was had become great friends with, and he and I were completely on the same wavelength, he retired, or he was sort of forced out because of changes at NPR. And so all of a sudden, that as a regular part of what I do has, I'm not sure if it's entirely dried up or it's just become a lot more difficult.
It's in transition, maybe?
Maybe. The airline magazines are all hurting, just terribly because of 9/11 and then the current economic climate. So I used to do probably half a dozen stories a year for these airline magazines, and I would get to do all kinds of creative stuff. I mean, just crazy stuff for them. And they would pay me very well, and that has pretty much stopped. So it's been a very strange time in that everything that I was accustomed to 5 years ago in terms of the rhythm of my life, the rhythm of my income, planning my time, how I judge success, how I judge a day well spent, all of those have changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, that's been very hard. In some respects, it's been good, because this is not a time to have a completely unstable freelance life at the age of 55, you know, with two children. But it's definitely a strange time, and I'm sort of still figuring out where my writing fits in all of this, mm-hmm. and how my writing is changing because of all of this.
And those are very useful stories, I think, for other writers to hear, because I'm sure that's a theme with everything being so difficult right now.
And it doesn't mean you're not a good writer. It doesn't mean there's nobody out there who wants your stuff. What it really means is that you just have to get to know your writing and the professional landscape that much better.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that the things that you are used to and familiar in terms of the routines of your life, maybe they aren't going to work, and you have to start finding new ones. And that's always the way, you know, periodically somebody that you've been working with who likes your stuff, etc., moves on, dies, you know, goes insane, whatever. And then you have to go out and start beating on some more doors again.
Yeah. My last question for you is, what advice might you offer to writers who are stuck in their work or need help moving forward? Do you have any exercises or activities that you generally turn to?
Almost always, when people feel stuck, or if they feel they've got writer's block, or they feel they can't continue with a particular writing project, etc., it's because they themselves have kind of put a barbed wire fence across part of their personality or part of their range of interests, and they've said, for whatever reason, I can't go there. And the more they've fenced off, the more likely it is that the thing they should really be writing is on the other side of that fence. I'll give you an example of that. I had a writing student a number of years ago who was clearly a really good writer and had interesting mind, and she kept on starting writing these short personal essays, which is what the class was that I was teaching, and then she would say, you know, I guess I lost interest, or I didn't know where to go with it, and this went on for half a semester, and eventually I said, you know, what is going on here? And she said, well, you know, it's really hard for me to keep this going because, well, for one thing, I'm in pain, and the other thing, the trial is coming up. And I kind of go, all right, you want to tell me about that? So it turns out that she had been in a very bad car accident. And she had been very badly injured, and she was doing physical therapy now. But as anyone who's done physical therapy knows, it ain't no day at the beach. You know, mm-hmm. it's painful, and she was in a lot of pain because of that. And the trial of the drunken guy who caused the accident was coming up, and she knew that that was going to bring up all kinds of bad stuff for a whole bunch of reasons. And that was what was on her mind. And I said, you know, that's what you should be writing about. You know, all of these, you know, other subjects you're picking up, they're clearly not as important to you and as central to who you are as this huge packing case of a thing that is just sitting right there on your doorstep, preventing you even getting outside the house. That's what you should be writing about. So she sort of went, well, how would I write about that? And so we worked out a number of ways that she could get at this subject, and she wound up writing a suite of pieces about it from different points of view, and they were terrific. And so really that my recommendation is that the writer who says, you know, I'm stuck, has usually got something important to say or something important to at least think about, and for whatever reason they've taken it off the table,
mm-hmm.
and they're looking at stuff that is less important or less interesting, at least at the moment. And so the chances are you need to step back and say, okay, and this is where anticipation comes in, you know, what would I really look forward to writing about right now? Irrespective of form, irrespective of genre, irrespective of income, all of those other things. What is the thing that if I had my druthers, I would really be writing about right now? And if you're in pain, write about pain. If you're sick, write about being sick. You know, those are the things that are right there with you. That will almost always mean that all of a sudden you kind of look at a much wider range of things and you start seeing, I guess I need to adjust my sights here.
Okay. That's great advice. Thank you very much for talking
to me
today.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tim Brooks. Many thanks to Burlington Guitar and Amp for letting us use their very soundproof room. Next week, tune in again at 9 a.m., our new time, to hear an interview with Vermont author Catherine Davis. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard today with author Tim Brooks. During our conversation, Tim said that often when people feel stuck, they have actually put up a fence around the thing they should be writing. Even if this mysterious fenced subject isn't what you've been trying to confront, perhaps it's time to have a look at it. What's on your mind? What are you avoiding? Are you procrastinating in order to keep from tackling something real or difficult? Give this some thought and see if you can identify something that's been wanting to be written about, something you've fenced off for whatever reason. Then take a journal and free write about this subject for 20 or 30 minutes. Ignore form, ignore genre. Don't worry about whether or not this is the subject you've been feeling stuck on. Write about the things that are there with you right now and see if this doesn't help you move forward in some larger way. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm closing out the show today with a guitar solo by our guest. This is Tim Brooks playing the Fairport Convention song, End of a Holiday, written by Simon Nicol. Stay tuned. Hank Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.